Welcome to Access Utah. This is Addison Pace. Two Cache Valley women are giving Utah prisoners a new chance behind bars and beyond. Their tool, a dried plant. Today on the program, producers Sherry Quinn and Elaine Taylor explore the Plants in Jail program, started by Sarah Lamb and Mary Barkworth, where inmates glue plant material onto archival paper for the Utah State University Herbarium. At 9:30, Science Questions presents the very first show presented on Utah airwaves, Racing the Future. Current automobile technology is developed on the racetrack. One of the most innovative engineering competitions in the world, the Le Mans Race, the American version of the Le Mans Race, stops in Utah, on the Miller Sports Raceway in Tooele. Science Questions takes to this racetrack to explore Globla Premier Auto Engineering. This will be coming up after the news. Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Mountain West Bank, a community bank offering a variety of services and summer loan options for consumers. At 110 South in Brigham City, information is at mountainwestbank.com. It's a division of Glacier Bank.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling round the bend. At night, seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps rolling all night.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. A group of Utah prisoners are getting an opportunity to give something back to the Utah community while also contributing to the scientific community, thanks to two local women.
It's something that really, when we started it, was rather utilitarian, self-interested on my part, I would have to say. But it's a pleasing feeling that perhaps you can actually benefit somebody else at the same time. And so now it's looking to see how can we make this happen? What can we do to make it more possible for everybody?
Producer Elaine Taylor talked to Sarah and Mary about their inmate work project, where a small group of prisoners at the Daggett County Jail in eastern Utah catalog plant and seed specimens for Utah State University's Intermountain Herbarium collections.
My name is Mary Barkworth, and I just retired from Utah State University, but I'm continuing as director of the herbarium there. I'm a plant taxonomist by background.
My name is Sarah Lamb. I am the adult education instructor for the Daggett School District in Manila.
As Elaine found out, this story begins with a chance meeting at a gardening event in Cache Valley in the fall of 2011.
When I was there, I saw a booth that was hosted by the Intermountain Herbarium. And as I looked through it, I could see that it was basically a repository for endangered and rare plants and seeds, which was very intriguing to me. And I vowed the next time I came to Logan that I would stop at the herbarium to see what it was all about. And while I was there, I met Michael Peep, who is the assistant curator, and Mary. And the three of us just hit it off, and we each share a love and a deep interest in botany and biology. And Mary knew what I do for a living, and she suggested that my inmates, I teach the inmates I help them with their high school diploma, and I help them earn their GED. And they needed some help with a collection that they had received from a retired couple in Arizona of 4,000 specimens. They needed help mounting them on archival paper with archival glue. And so Mary suggested that I have my inmates that I teach work on this project to help them.
Mary, could you tell me about the background of the plants, how they ended up here?
They ended up here by a bit of a circuitous route. The Walkers, who were the collectors, had a seed business down in Arizona. They would collect seeds and make them available to other people, sell them. And if you want to be sure that you've got the right seeds, or you can tell somebody these are this plant, you have a herbarium specimen to back it up. So they had been doing this for several years. This is how they've been earning their living. But they've gotten to the point where they wanted to reduce the size of things and basically get rid of the collection too. But they wanted it to go somewhere useful. And they know Pat and Noel Holmgren, who write the Intermountain Flora and have done a lot of exploration and got to know a lot of the botanists in the region and adjacent areas. And so they asked Pat and Noel if they had any idea of who would like to receive these specimens. And Noel's father actually was my predecessor in the Intermountain Herbarium, so he asked whether we would be interested in having them. And I said yes, because it would strengthen our holdings. I thought it was going to be primarily from southern Arizona and Mexico, but there's also a lot from other parts of the world.
Now they have a group of prisoners preparing and cataloging a collection of more than 4,000 plant and seed specimens for the herbarium. Sarah describes the process.
We take this herbarium glue. It's a very expensive, very nice glue.
And archival.
And archival as well. And glue the specimens back down onto the paper. We don't lift them off and put them on a different piece of paper because that would compromise the integrity of that specimen. Instead, we take the whole thing and glue it onto an additional piece of paper that is archival, provided by the herbarium with archival glue. The guys cut off the label that has been handwritten. We enter that data into the computer with the idea that we will print off the label so that it's easier to read and re-glue it back on there with this archival glue. And then we file them away, and it's there for hopefully 1,000 years, forever and ever.
A herbarium is a collection of preserved plant specimens, whole plants, or parts of plants, that are each labeled with scientific information about the specimen. They are used as reference material in describing plant types and taxa.
You can go back and look at the specimen that they collected and re-examine it and say, yes, that is, or perhaps, oh, it's something close, but it's not quite the one they said. So we can get a better idea of where species can grow and cannot grow, and therefore what the impact of various changes will have on them. It's also for learning when people are going out into the field. And I had an inquiry today from somebody who's going to be working in the Uinta Basin, and she wanted to know how could she get to know the plants of that area. She's working for an environmental company. And I actually referred her to the Uinta Basin Herbarium that's in the Vernal campus and said, you know, there would be a source. So it's a teaching thing. They were originally set up. It was a huge technological innovation in the 1500s. Because instead of having to grow your plants in a botanic garden, you dry them, stick them on paper, and now you can put them on the back of a horse and carry them across the Alps. This is in the days when America hadn't been discovered. Well, just after. And it makes it easy to have plants that you from all over the world that you can study. So in the Intermountain Herbarium, we've got 265,000 specimens, and we've databased about 40%. And slightly over half of them are from what we consider our core district, Utah, Nevada, and Idaho. The rest are from all the way around the world. And so that gives us a context. We're not looking just at our own things. We're looking at them as they occur in neighboring areas.
Could you tell me more about the preservation process? Why you had to start switching them over to different papers and different ways of keeping them?
Well, I suppose the basic thing is it's the paper that comes in. I mentioned that herbaria started around, well, it started this way of preserving plants in the early 1500s. Those specimens can still be studied. It's relatively inexpensive. I mean, it's not like you have to get a freeze dryer out and do all this equipment. But it really is very, very effective for plants. But the problem is if you get paper that is non-archival or acidic or something like that, in that span of 500 years, it's going to become brittle. It may have an impact on the plant, but I think mostly it's that the paper becomes brittle and then it no longer provides the support for this plant material, which, when it's dry, is very fragile.
Storing them for hundreds of years, even thousands, is important because herbarium specimens can show evidence of a change in the climate pattern.
It's partly through herbarium specimens that they've been able to demonstrate there really has been a change in the time at which plants flower. So if you've got herbarium specimens of the same plants that have been collected from the same area, and you can go back through to the 1800s and 1700s, which they can in Europe.
This idea was tested in the U.S. in 2002. Flowering times during the year 2003 of 229 living plants growing at an arboretum in Boston, Massachusetts, were compared with 372 records of flowering times from 1885 to 2002, using herbarium specimens of the same individual plants. During this time, Boston experienced an increase in mean annual temperature. From 1980 on, flowering time became progressively earlier, 8 days earlier than in the late 1800s.
Time it takes a boy to come of age. A tiny drop could slide down a window pane, yet the traveler travels on. The traveler travels on.
I had read that you got these plants and they weren't on the right paper.
Right.
But that you couldn't afford to pay, like, college students to move them onto archival paper. And so this is where you became involved. How did you introduce this project to the inmates?
Mary actually showed up in Manila one morning to where I work at the jail, and we had a meeting with the county sheriff and presented the idea to him for his final approval, which he was very supportive of and in favor of. And then during my class period, I presented it to my inmates and asked them if they would be interested in doing this, and they jumped at the chance. Because for one thing, it gets them out of their sections. It breaks up the monotony of the day. They are able to earn a little bit of money. The cost or whatever they are being paid is minimal compared to what Mary would have to pay one of her students. But they earn something. They are aware that they are involved where the biology department from Utah State can come in and take plant samples for genetic studies or DNA testing. So they're involved in that process, even though they're behind bars. It teaches them skills. It maybe introduces interest to them that they may not have had prior to this, so that when they get out, they will have something as a backup for employment or whatever.
I would like to make the point, we have kept the number of students that we hire in the herbarium up because I don't want to deprive the undergraduates of a job. But we are now looking at how can we introduce into it, if you like, some intellectual content, introduce them to some of the concepts such as georeferencing and databases and how do you identify a plant, what do you mean by a plant species. So far, basically what we've done has been ask them to help us. And now we're looking a little harder about, without putting them into courses and exams, et cetera, but introduce them to some concepts so that when they get out, things will ring bells that might not have rung bells before. You know, they'll feel happier and more at ease, perhaps in going into a technical program that involves something to do with computers or that involves something to do with plants. And so put them a little further ahead.
Inmates receive a modest wage that allows them to make purchases at the jail commissary. Contributing to the herbarium boosts their confidence, says Sarah.
It gives them a sense of direction, a sense of worth. The recidivism rate in the state of Utah is over 80%. So that, to me, says that the rehabilitation process behind bars is not working. So what Mary and I would like to do is to allow these guys the opportunity to learn skills. Like she said, maybe bells will go off that haven't gone off before, so that when they get out, they have an opportunity to use these skills in a place of employment.
How long are most of these men in jail for?
It varies on the crimes that they've committed. I have one of my students, his original sentence was 18 months. I have another student whose sentence has been 6 years. So it varies with the degree of the crime they've committed.
How have they reacted to the program? Do they say that they like it? Do they want to do more?
They do want to do more. In fact, we just finished up all of the work that needed to be done for the Walker collection. And the last thing the guys asked me when I left is, would you please ask Mary if there's something else we can do?
And actually, one of the things realized that they had done work with that was a bit more complicated than I had originally envisioned, and we had held some specimens back as being they would need more thought going into it. And now I'm looking at it and saying, no, they could do these. They're fine. And so it's been a learning experience for me, and it actually has been very enjoyable, the thought that, okay, there's a group of people here that think
for whom it is an enjoyable, different occupation, and they're going to learn something. And if we can make it so they learn a little more without thinking that we're going to convert them into botanists or anything like that, but that maybe they might, this is the little thing you don't say too much, they might notice a few more plants when they get outside and, you know, be a bit more interested in them. But I think something that, at least for me, I'm having to work my way through as to how much we can expect. And the databasing aspect would be a huge help to us. But we want to make it in such a way we've got to do some things because there are restrictions. They're not allowed access to the internet. And the program that we use in the herbarium relies on the internet. But at the same time, in working out how we can work without the internet at the Daggett County Jail is helping me because I'm also trying to work with some people who have herbaria in it, places like Iraq and maybe Pakistan and Tajikistan, and realizing that we get used to cheap, easy internet, and we're exceptional in the world. So if we can make it so that it could work off the internet in Daggett County Jail, we can make something that will be useful in other parts of the world too.
If we could somehow put this program onto a disk of some sort to where the guys can access it without having the internet, and as Mary said, we can expand that and take it to other parts of the world, other herbaria.
Have you had inmates express interest in taking classes in this field after they're out or pursuing something related to this?
I've had one inmate express an interest to enroll at Utah State for the fall of 2013, and so that's exciting to me. One of the things that I encourage these inmates is to continue on with their higher education. Don't just stop at a GED or a diploma. That's not enough in today's world. They have to have a higher education. It was very thrilling and satisfying for me to hear this inmate express his desire to go on to Utah State.
The challenge, she says, is motivating the inmates to stay interested in the program.
It's not a traditional school setting. There are adults. They don't have to come to school if they don't want to. There are repercussions, but it's not like they're going to get a bad grade or they're going to have a detention or they've gotten a slough. It's a completely different setup. And so there is going to have to be some sort of stops in place to encourage them to come and to give them that motivation.
But on the other side of it, though, is that if they're not performing or whatever, then they're cut out of it. And so you've lost the ability to earn the money that you can use in the commissary.
Right.
And you've lost that kind of break in the day.
Has this whole process made you more, not willing, but maybe look for other experiences that you can bring into the jail like this?
Oh, absolutely. Mary and I have some ideas. One thing that she suggested is that we propose to Sheriff Jorgensen a chicken raising project. This would give them an opportunity to learn about poultry and raise maybe eggs for their breakfast. Maybe they would even learn how to
kill the chickens.
Kill the chickens.
In which case, I could use them if I get some. No, they probably wouldn't. I mean, I don't know how he would feel about that. But
I don't know either.
But again, it's also something that, you know, you could do that after you get out.
The benefit then, if nothing else, is just the satisfaction of knowing that you have skills and that you have done something worthwhile. In fact, one of the inmates said to me, as I was taking photographs for one of the articles, one of the inmates said to me, oh, yes, I would love to have my photograph taken. I would love to be photographed doing something good.
You seem to have moved from not having any involvement with the inmates to be proposing a lot of ideas. How has this changed your perspective on all of this?
It's made me look at how can we do it. I've thought about it before. I actually tossed out the ideas to some colleagues a few years ago, but you need to have a connection into the system. I didn't know anybody, either inside or outside the jail, to be honest. So when Sarah said that she worked with the inmates, it was sort of like, oh, maybe we can do that. And I was asked once why we didn't work with the Cache County Jail, and that's the answer, because Sarah works at Daggett. And
where Mary and I were friends, it just kind of fell into place.
So personal connections make a lot of difference. But and now looking at it, and it's sort of saying, okay, from education background, from the science background, and knowing something about some of the grant funding programs, how can we pull this all together to be of more benefit both to the herbarium but also to the inmates? Because that the U.S. has this horrendously high proportion of its population in jail at one time, any one time. And as Pierre said, there's the recidivism rate.
And in 2009, the recidivism rate was 60%. So from 2009 to 2013, it has gone from 60% to over 80%. So that says glaringly that something is not working. And not that Mary and I think that we can
fix that one. No.
We can fix the whole problem. But we can certainly do our part. And we would like to try that. We would like that opportunity.
I am firmly convinced, and I think most of us are, that learning never hurts. You may not go on in that field, but you'll be surprised how often it comes up.
You'll be surprised at what doors will open because of what you know and what you can do. And so, absolutely, I agree with that.
It seems like an untapped resource, though.
It does seem like an untapped resource, and that's what's so exciting about it, is that we can pretty much do what we want to do. I think there are a lot of different components to this, and Mary and I are just beginning to explore them and to see exactly what it is we want to do with these guys and how can we help them. What is the best thing we can do for them? So yes, it is. It's very exciting.
Sarah and Mary are working with the Daggett County Sheriff Jerry Jorgensen on another project called Hoop House that teaches inmates how to grow vegetables for the jail's cafeteria. Thanks for listening. Sherry Quinn for Access Utah.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by Logan Summerfest Arts Fair, June 13th through 15th, featuring Providence artist Kay Homan, daily musical performances, food, and children's activities, in addition to jewelry, photography, pottery, and fine art. Information at logansummerfest.com.
Up some prime works of art, culinary creations at locations in Moab, St. George, and Logan, and bid on several bed and breakfast stays when you ante up during UPR's online auction. Let the bidding begin by going to upr.org, where you can purchase items and support programming on UPR. Bid from the comfort of your own personal computer now through June 18th. You are making money for UPR and getting some fantastic framed art or a stylish haircut from someone who supports UPR. So join in now by going to upr.org and let the bidding begin.
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Sherry Quinn. Today on the program, we are going behind the scenes of the super high-tech race car world. Here, human ingenuity and innovation are put into making the most advanced cars on the planet. The sports car race called the American Le Mans is held in the United States and Canada. It is based on the world's oldest endurance race, the 24-hour Le Mans, which races near the town of Le Mans, France. The technology at these races has a trickle-down effect, finding its way to production cars. Unlike a car race such as NASCAR, where all the cars look relatively alike, the Le Mans cars look wildly different from one another. Some cars have open-air cockpits and no doors, while others have doors and closed cockpits. Some bellow a thunderous tone, and others deliver soft, subtle notes as they soar around the racetrack. The cars of the future are developed here. Driving one of them takes endurance, smarts, skill, talent, and a childhood dream, according to Emmanuel Piro. He is an Italian Formula One driver and five-time winner of the 24-hour Le Mans. He began racing go-karts at age 11, and by 18, he was a professional race car driver.
You always have to prove yourself, so you're always on the edge.
On a warm blue sky summer morning at the American Le Mans Series at Miller Motorsports Park in Tooele, Utah, the race day starts with a ceremony for the crowd of several thousand, eagerly anticipating the race. The Le Mans cars reach speeds upwards of 200 miles an hour, and there are constant passes and takeovers, making it a thrill to watch. I talked to Piero a couple of hours before the race, one of the last of his career.
I think, first of all, racing as any other activity started because just people liked it. There's a saying which says the first race was held when the second car was built. So when there were two cars on the world, they started racing. The reason why it's so popular and the reason why all the car manufacturers are involved since many, many years is because they found out that through racing, they could develop all their technology from one side and promote their technology from another side much better and faster than in a normal field. I think it's like in the war, you know, aviation especially, thanks to World War II, the planes made a huge step forward. And now we've got very advanced planes thanks to the military development. And racing is doing the same without killing people. And it's a very attractive sport for the fans.
Piero is driving a diesel engine car today. In the U.S., gasoline and diesel fuel are inexpensive compared to their cost in Europe. Diesel and gasoline essentially come from the same barrel of oil. But in the U.S., diesel is federally taxed at a higher rate than gas. In Europe, however, it is the opposite. Gas is taxed at a higher rate than diesel. Over time, this led to a higher demand for diesel cars in Europe. Diesel engines are more expensive to manufacture, but they are cleaner and more fuel efficient.
In America, whilst normally you guys are always leading the technology, you know, all the new things first happen in America and then we copy in Europe. This is actually the other way around. You know, diesel is very established in Europe and here is still seen as a truck fuel, a dirty thing. And I think it'll take a while before people realize that the diesel which is mounted in the car is a very, very high-tech motor with very clean emissions.
Piero's car is called the Audi R10 TDI. In 2006, the Audi TDI was the first diesel car to win arguably the toughest car race in the world, the 24-hour Le Mans. Piero was part of the winning team behind the wheel. Most diesel automobiles are turbocharged. That means more air is forced into the engine to create more power. The Audi R10 TDI is the quietest race car at this event. Engineer Brad Kettler is the technical director for Audi's North America team.
And the turbochargers themselves knock a lot of the noise energy out of the exhaust stream. And to paraphrase or quote Mr. Baratsky here from the engine department, he prefers to use the energy to make power than to make noise. So, and that's true, because the energy that the turbochargers capture and are able to put back into the engine uses a lot of the thermal energy and a lot of the energy that's available in the exhaust stream to drive the car rather than to make a lot of noise out the back. Also, on the R10, we use particle filters that are developed with our technical partner, Dow Chemical. And these particle filters, in essence, act like a muffler. They are present in the exhaust stream and offer some level of muffling, because they deaden the sound a bit. And so these elements all together combine to make an engine which is perceived as very, very smooth, because it is. It's absolutely velvet, butter smooth.
The American Le Mans Series was the first motorsport racing competition to be recognized as a green racing series by the Environmental Protection Agency. In 2008, the Chevrolet Corvette C6R ran on cellulosic ethanol, which is a biofuel produced from wood, grasses, or the non-edible parts of plants. The Corvette and the Audi both ran on low CO2-emitting green engines. Scott Atherton is president and CEO of the American Le Mans Series. He says the cars competing in this race determine the future of road cars.
The American Le Mans Series is a number of things. In very simple terms, it could be described as the premium brand of auto racing. And what's meant by that is that it features luxury and performance cars that are from the highest profile, highest demographic brands in the world. So it's Audi, Porsche, Ferrari, Acura, and others like them that separates this form of motorsport from virtually anything else.
The famous Formula One race is a massive event with a global audience of 600 million people for each race. It is also the world's most expensive sport, and the cars reach speeds up to 220 miles per hour. The cars in the American Le Mans series go nearly as fast and cost upwards of $1 million each.
The technology of Formula One is spectacular. It's fantastic. It has always been known, in modern times at least, as the pinnacle of motorsport. It is where technology is introduced and maintained at its highest possible level. It is the highest level of automotive technology that man can create. And for people that appreciate that, there is no better form of motorsport. Where we differ is in the practical application of that technology. Our technical advances, with very few exceptions, are all directly tied to a practical application of that technology to the road car. And here you have this spectacular R10 TDI diesel Audi that is racing around out there at the head of the pack. It is so quiet, it's eerie. There is virtually no smoke whatsoever, and the performance of that car can only be described as staggering. And that exact same engine architecture, that exact same technology, is what's going into the next generation of Audi road cars. So there is that practical, relevant, direct link, the DNA of that race car transplanted into the DNA of the road car.
The American Le Mans is anywhere from an hour and 40 minutes to 12 hours depending on the race. The race at Miller Motorsports is about 2.5 hours, and each car is driven by two alternating drivers. Brad Kettler says the competing teams are comprised of at least a dozen people working together to win.
I like cars. The thing I think that sustains you, there's a couple of things that I'll point out that for me are very special. One is the cars themselves. I mean, I consider it an honor to get to work on these things and to get to be part of them. I mean, I was so passionate about the R8 that I would get welled up when I talked about it because I just loved the car. It was a beautiful, elegant, you know, just absolute thoroughbred of a race car, and I really, really loved it. And when it retired, it was replaced by the R10, which I was a little bit unsure about, but it's earned its same place in my heart with it because it is so cool. And so I enjoy that aspect of it. I like looking at them. I like working on them. I like talking about them. So for me, it's an easy thing to do. Secondary to that, when you have a good race team and you are working well, there's a real electricity to it. And I consider that to be something similar to a ballet company or to a symphony orchestra, a concentrated effort of a group of people. And what we do as a group of people is pretty extraordinary. We work extremely hard. This is not a glamorous business. It takes a strong constitution, a lot of early mornings, a lot of late nights. You miss a lot of your kids' birthdays. But the electricity of the team and the team atmosphere when it's really clicking and really going well is something special.
Back in the Audi trailer, driver Emmanuel Pirdo talks about his lifelong passion for racing and what it takes to compete at the top of his sport.
Racing in America, I really, really like it because it's difficult to explain in a few words. I wish I was better in doing this, but you guys welcome the racing so much. It's such a nice relationship between athletes and people, between athletes and press. It's just very, very, very nice to race here, and I'm not telling you because I'm on American radio. I really, really mean it. And on top of that, you have really beautiful racetracks. Salt Lake City in particular is one of my favorite places because Utah is just, it's a stunning place. I like nature, I like wildlife, and And here, just the other day, I was flying with a friend with a little airplane. I'm a pilot, over these beautiful canyons, and this place, I really love it.
What do you prefer, flying or driving?
I really consider myself very blessed. That's why you will see me very often with a smile on my face, because I was born with this great passion for driving since I was a little kid, and I started very early, and now the years are going by. I'm 43 and I'm still doing it with a lot of success and a lot of passion. Flying, I always loved it. I only started not so many years ago, and now I enjoy my little aircraft and I go around. But one thing is, I don't want to say a profession, because although of course I make a very good living out of it, I never consider this as a job. So it's the thing I do it all the time, and flying is a hobby, of course.
What's your passion for racing?
When I was a little kid, I remember I was 6 or 7, I saw one falling star from the sky. It's still very vivid in my memory. And you know, you have a wish, and the wish was to become a racing driver, although I had no idea. It's like when you wish to become an astronaut, you know, it's such an intangible thing, such a faraway thing. But I was lucky enough that by accident we stopped somewhere where there was a little go-kart track when I was 11. We rented one, and you know, you asked me, when was your first love? I don't think about the girl, I think about this go-kart, because since then I was captured by this little car, and then things just happened slowly. I really thank God that I kept an incredible passion for so many years. There's a lot of drivers who do this, I don't want to say only for the money, but it's kind of a routine, and it's just the way they do it every day. I enjoy every single minute, and now, because of course I've done so much and I'm towards the end of my career, I see it as, you know, when you eat a very, very nice dish that you really, really like to eat it, and you are at the end, you know, the last mouthpiece, the last bites, you really try to chew and enjoy them very much, because you know it's not going to be there any longer. The feeling you get when you drive a race car at the limit at these speeds, it's very hard to describe, but I find, although I do a lot of extreme sports, I find hard to have the same strong feelings, to be very close to the limit in terms of perfection and in terms of danger, as motor racing gives me.
So is it adrenaline? Are you ever nervous?
I'm nervous and I'm afraid, and I think the drivers who say that they are not, they are liars.
You're the first one to admit that.
Because I think it's we know what we risk. Adrenaline, it's actually funny because I'm just starting a clothing company called Adrenalina, which is Italian adrenaline, based on motor racing outfit. And so this is a proof that for me adrenaline is a big thing, but it has to be a good mixture. You know, a lot of people think drivers or riders are crazy. It's nowhere near that. There's all calculated risk, and there's no room for people who are only crazy or brave.
To find out what the drivers really go through when they are racing, I decided to take a ride in a Porsche race car with test driver Jason Alts. It was not what I expected. My head got jerked around, and it took all my strength to keep my neck in place.
Wait. Now you start to accelerate aggressively, headed down towards the back straight away.
And how fast are we going?
Right now we are going 125 miles an hour.
Oh my God.
So we're on the brakes aggressively, getting the car slowed down. This is the second slowest turn on the circuit. You have to be very, very patient as you come through here, because the road really doesn't unwind until the exit of the corner.
I have a whole new appreciation now.
Exactly. And that's the point. I mean, that's why we're out here giving rides to you guys.
Set a place, Pat Long in the sixth car, the sister car, the gap at the end, 22 seconds. But Simon Pagenaud.
Patrick Long is an American race car driver who has earned many victories at multiple races around the world. He drives for the Porsche Penske team, which he calls the New York Yankees of motorsports.
I've been racing my whole life for 20 years. I'm 26. I started racing go-karts right out of diapers, and I've made it my whole life, and fortunately I'm paid now to make it my career.
G-force is a measure of acceleration.
One G-force equals the force of gravity at the Earth's surface. G-forces sustained at about 10 Gs can be deadly or lead to injury. Patrick Long and his German teammate Sascha Mawson explain what the body and brain endure inside the car during a race.
Pulling over 4.5 Gs of lateral G-forces on the body. So just that alone, combined with the mental stress and the high temperatures, somewhere in the range of 40 to 60 degrees above what the outside temperature is the temperature inside the cockpit. So to put it into a relative perspective, it would be like being at a mild jog or exercise bike inside a sauna for 3 or 4 hours. So hydration and endurance is a huge, huge factor.
Actually, after a race, I was in intensive care because of overheating in a closed car. And it was in 1998, which was my worst experience that I had, because I was out for 6 weeks because of concentration problems with overheating. Everything in the brain gets a little bit cooked, and it takes a little while to recover. But nowadays, there's also technology to help you. We are using cool vests in the closed cockpit cars, and I have the best possibility. I have a cabriolet. I'm driving with no roof. This keeps you cool as well.
Racing is risky, and it takes commitment, lots of it, explains Long.
You know, racing to me is all I've ever done and all I really have ever known. Since I can remember, I was naturally drawn to anything with wheels and engines. And go-karting and motorcycles was just a passion from, you know, before I knew how to analyze. So to naturally progress into something where I can make a living is something that I realize I'm very lucky to be able to do. And it's a 1% demographic of people that can make a nice living doing it. So, you know, I don't take it for granted, but at the same time, I know I would be doing this on the weekends with my 9-to-5 money if I wasn't racing for a living. So it's great to be able to do what I love and be paid to do it.
How hard was it to be a racer?
Oh, with racing, it's a lot different than a stick and ball sport. If you're a golfer or a tennis player, you need to be amazingly talented, very driven, and very practiced. With racing, you need all of that, but you also need a motorsport management marketing background. You have to realize that sponsorship is the real drive force behind this, and without that, your talent can't really be displayed. So that was the challenging part for me, was convincing people to give me a shot and to let me show them what I could do. It's so expensive to get a car out on a racetrack that you can't just go to your local club and excel through with pure talent. You have to have the marketing and the political background to get through, and it's amazing how much you learn as a youngster racing go-karts locally. You're already dealing with sponsors on a much smaller basis, and it's kind of hardwired into you. So that's the real challenge.
Long has an internal angst to compete, and racing seems to quench it.
So many times, like in everything in the world, it's you against yourself. And if you really focus on that and the elements of working with your team and fighting against the race itself, you sometimes find that you have little competition because people are so focused on what everyone else is doing that they miss the actual, you know, pinnacle of what you need to be working on. So just a tremendous different amount of feelings that I can describe. But in the end, I'm a competitive person by nature, and everything I do is I want to be the best at, and I want to work the hardest to be that much better. And I think racing is the best avenue for me to get rid of that internal vibe.
Series president Scott Atherton.
If you are not a driver at a world-class level, and I mean that in all sincerity, you don't belong here. And that's not intended to be standoffish or elitist. It's just the professionalism of the series has risen so rapidly that those who haven't measured up have found another alternative, which is probably a heck of a lot more fun for them. Be the equivalent of a walk-on high school second string football player attempting to play in the NFL. They'd get tired of going home beat up every night. It's truly a competitive environment where the best combination of car, engine, tires, driver is going to be what wins.
And these cars are paving the way for the next wave of street cars.
Once a year, when the top sports car teams from around the world gather at Le Mans for the annual 24-hour race, it is typically, if not always, the America Le Mans Series teams, which are the teams to beat. So when we say that the America Le Mans Series is world class, That's one of the reasons we say that, is literally these teams, these drivers, these cars, on a global scale, are the benchmark by which everything else is compared to.
Patrick Long describes his ride, the Porsche RS Spyder. It is bright gold with thick red stripes on each upper side and sits low to the ground. Finely toned and muscular, it is a motorized masterpiece.
Probably over $1 million in four wheels of motion, so certainly a great ride and very, very technical. You have onboard telemetry systems, data acquisition, black box type recording systems out of your, you know, aviation core group, and you know, everything on that car is either titanium or carbon fiber to make it as light as possible. So just the engineering and the dynamics and the fundamentals of the car before you get it on track and have to, you know, put tires on it and fuel in it and rebuild the engines, it's a huge, huge cost. And that's why sponsorship and marketing is such a big part. Right now, a big thing is clean burning fuels, the green system that's coming through motorsport. And you know, with the E85, you know, you have a blend of ethanol with fuel. This is about giving back to the environment, and certainly it's a kind of a cliche to have a bunch of race cars going around the track at high axis, you know, high rates of speed, and to think about environmental safety, but it's things that we get back, give back to the road-going public, that really that's where the rates of pollution are created. So it's all about that awareness and also the developing that science.
It's when you get that trifecta that it really starts to pay dividends. And that's occurring right now. And I think you're going to see rapid development of technology that addresses alternative fuels, harmful emission reduction, greater fuel efficiency of currently available fuels, and development of alternative propulsion systems, you know, hydrogen, fuel cell technology. And I suspect that there's some things out there that you and I haven't even heard of yet, that's just in its virtual gestation form, that hopefully in the not distant future you'll see it show up in the American Le Mans series first.
That was Scott Atherton, American Le Mans series president. Rivalry is the key to making better, cleaner cars, according to Brad Ketterly.
Competition drives innovation, and you can't really quantify a single element of motor racing as either an advantage or a disadvantage as far as, you know, what we consume to do this. I mean, the innovations that come out of this are, there's sports medicine, tire development, the technology development of the cars. There's just so many areas that it goes into. The only way you can spark that kind of innovation and advance that innovation so aggressively is through competition. There's a lot of other of my colleagues that are in this paddock that would probably have some canned answer for this that I really don't. But, I mean, you take the Utah Jazz here, that obviously a fantastic sports team, and what they spend in jet fuel to go to a couple of away games is way, way more than what we use to run this race here. The way to win these races is to be faster and more efficient than the other guy. And so with that being, you know, the carrot that's being dangled, people are going to work hard on it. And it's not about making a bigger engine and putting a bigger fuel tank in it. You can't do that. You have a certain number of parameters you have to live with.
The cars are so souped up with state-of-the-art electronics, they are automated machines. Who needs a pilot?
With so many advanced data systems and abilities to measure and monitor things, that there is still room in this business for intuition. And, you know, that communication between the driver and the engineer and the driver and the crew chief and so forth is still an absolutely essential thing. It has to be there, because if it was such a dry science that you didn't need that, you wouldn't need to run the race.
Piloting the car takes Patrick Long to another dimension.
I'll tell you what it is. In racing, there's so much focus needed to control an automobile at that speed that it's the best escape that you can find mentally. There's no time to process anything else or to think about the weather or, you know, your family or work or anything that could be stressing you. It's really an outer body experience, and that's the biggest thing, and that's the biggest thrill for people on an amateur level that come and race. They find it is an escape from the stresses of life and things that aren't as fun, and it's really something that doesn't allow you to process any other thoughts.
It does not seem right to talk about racing without mentioning the crashes. Long's teammate Sasha Mawson was happy to show me a video on YouTube of one of the worst pileups he has ever been in. It happened in a race called the Formula 3 Grand Prix in Macau, China. A good sense of humor goes a long way in this chancy line of work.
Now, boom, he crashes. And he broke his neck. And everybody's crashing into that.
Wow.
I had marks on my helmet of the tire that of the guy that hit me.
You were lucky.
I was lucky, yeah. Look at this, how they are on top of each other. This is like, I think, like 1.5 million of wreckage.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
There's the good saying of an older race car driver who said, "I remember the times when racing was dangerous and sex was safe."
Yeah.
That was German race car driver Sascha Mawson. By the way, he and Patrick Long took second place at this race.
Another silver, whatever. Something to catch the dust.
Italian driver Emmanuel Pirro crashed and walked away without a scratch. But his face wore the wound of disappointment. Losing is also one of the consequences of racing the future. And that's our show for this week. Thanks for listening. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn, Susie Montgomery, and Constance Crompton.
Well Moment is made possible by the USU Department of Human Resources Wellness Program at usu.edu/HR.
Sticking to a regular exercise schedule isn't easy. After all, there are plenty of potential hindrances: time, boredom, injuries, and self-confidence. But these issues don't need to stand in your way. Consider practical strategies for overcoming common barriers to fitness. Squeeze in short walks throughout the day. If you don't have time for a full workout, don't sweat it. Shorter spurts of exercise, such as 10 minutes of walking spaced throughout the day, offer benefits too. Choose activities you enjoy. You'll be more likely to stay interested. Remember, anything that gets you moving counts. Exercise with friends, relatives, neighbors, or coworkers. You'll enjoy the camaraderie and the encouragement of the group. Schedule exercise as you would schedule an important appointment. Block off times for physical activity and make sure your friends and family are aware of your commitment. Whatever you decide to do, stick with it and remember why you're doing it. Your heart will thank you. This is Dana for the Be Well program at Utah State University. Be well, Utah.
Northern Utah's Summerfest Arts Fair celebrates 30 years, and UPR will be there this Saturday for the recording art project, The Sounds of Summerfest. Stop by our booth and share your memories about a fair that has become a favorite for artists and musicians and the community. Do you remember your first purchase at the fair? What's your favorite food, or is it the music that brings you out to mingle among the art-loving masses? We want to know. It's a celebration of sound during this week's Summerfest, when throughout the day on Saturday, we sponsor sound recording sessions brought to you as a community service by Utah Public Radio, UPR. It is art heard on the airways.
Act
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.